This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mastery, The Keys to Success and Long-Term Fulfillment by George Leonard. Narrated by Timothy Andres Pabon. Introduction. In 1987, for the fourth straight year, the May issue of Esquire magazine featured a special section on what it called Ultimate Fitness. These special sections claimed a broader charter than is usual for such a subject. Ultimately, I wrote in the first of the series, fitness and health are related to everything we do, think, and feel. Thus, what we are calling ultimate fitness has less to do with running a 2-hour and 30-minute marathon than with living a good life. The previous ultimate fitness specials had enjoyed exceptionally high reader interest, but the May 1987 number was something else again. The subject this time was mastery. The mysterious process during which what is at first difficult becomes progressively easier and more pleasurable through practice. The purpose of the feature was to describe the path that best led to mastery, not just in sports, but in all of life, and to warn against the prevailing bottom-line mentality that puts quick, easy results ahead of long-term dedication to the journey itself. The response was immediate and extravagant. Requests for extra copies, tear sheets, and reprints poured in. Management newsletters requested permission to reprint portions of the Esquire feature. Corporate CEOs gave photocopies to their officers. Training groups of a wide variety spent hours discussing the mastery principles. Letters to the editor were numerous and eloquent. A Navy carrier pilot, for instance, wrote that he had been having trouble landing the F-14 Tomcat on an aircraft carrier. I was in the process of making a second and perhaps final attempt when I bought the May issue. Insights that I gained from Mr. Leonard's outline of the master's journey gave me the extra 10% of mental discipline that I needed to make the trek down this portion of my path a relatively easy one. I knew a book was needed to provide a full understanding of how to get on and stay on the path of mastery, but at the time I was working on a memoir of the 1960s. I thought interest in the subject might wane, but it hasn't. The many comments and inquiries that I continue to receive have convinced me more than ever that the quick fix, fast temporary relief, bottom line mentality doesn't work in the long run and is eventually destructive to the individual and the society. If there is any sure route to success and fulfillment in life, it is to be found in the long-term, essentially goalless process of mastery. This is true, it appears, in personal as well as professional life, in economics as well as ice skating, in medicine as well as martial arts. It was the martial arts, in fact, that gave me the original idea for the Esquire feature and for this book. I have practiced Aikido since 1970 and have taught it regularly since 1976. With its sophisticated blending moves and full repertory of rolls and falls, Aikido is generally known as the most difficult of the martial arts to master. On the training mat, every attempt at circumvention or overreaching is revealed. Flaws are made manifest. The quick fix is impossible. At the same time, the pleasures of practice are intensified. The mat, I often tell my students, is the world, but it is the world under a magnifying glass. An Aikido school is therefore an ideal laboratory for studying the factors that work for and against long-term learning. As hundreds of students passed through our school, I began to recognize distinctive patterns in the way they approach the art. The types of learners I would later characterize as the dabbler, the obsessive, and the hacker, see Chapter 2, revealed themselves, in most cases, after only a few classes. I was surprised to discover that it wasn't necessarily the most talented who would persevere on the long road to black belt and beyond. I began to realize that although different people might take different paths to mastery, all of the paths led in the same general direction, one that could be clearly mapped. But would my findings at the Aikido school apply to other skills? Interviews conducted at the time of the Esquire special and since then, along with the extraordinary response to the magazine feature itself, have shown me that what is true for Aikidoists is also true for learners in any non-trivial skill. Managers, artists, pilots, schoolchildren, college students, carpenters, athletes, parents, religious devotees, and even entire cultures in the process of change. Bottom-line thinking might now prevail, but the master's journey has deep roots. It also has deep resonance. One might say, in fact, that it's not so much an idea whose time has come as an idea that has always been with us. It's just that we need to be reminded. I'm pleased that so many people's lives have already been changed for the better through this reminder, and I hope the book will add to the number of those who are on the path. Part 1. The Master's Journey. Introduction. Start with something simple. Try touching your forehead with your hand. Ah, that's easy, automatic, nothing to it. But there was a time when you were as far removed from the mastery of that simple skill as a non-pianist is from playing a Beethoven sonata. First, you had to learn to control the movements of your hands. You were just a baby then, and somehow get them to move where you wanted them to. You had to develop some sort of kinesthetic image of your body so that you could know the relationship between your forehead and other parts of your body. You had to learn to match this image with the visual image of an adult's body. You had to learn how to mimic your mother's actions. Momentous stuff. Make no mistake about it. And we haven't yet considered the matter of language, learning to decode sounds shaped as words and to match them to our own actions. Only after all this could you play the learning game that parents everywhere play with their children. Where's your nose? Where are your ears? Where's your forehead? As with all significant learning, this learning was measured not in a straight line, but in stages. Brief spurts of progress separated by periods during which you seemed to be getting nowhere. Still, you learned an essential skill. What's more important, you learned about learning. You started with something difficult and made it easy and pleasurable through instruction and practice. You took a master's journey, and if you could learn to touch your forehead, you can learn to play a Beethoven sonata or fly a jet plane, to be a better manager or improve your relationships. Our current society works in many ways to lead us astray, but the path of mastery is always there waiting for us. Chapter 1. What is mastery? It resists definition, yet can be instantly recognized. It comes in many varieties, yet follows certain unchanging laws. It brings rich rewards, yet is not really a goal or a destination, but rather a process, a journey. We call this journey mastery, and tend to assume that it requires a special ticket available only to those born with exceptional abilities. But mastery isn't reserved for the super talented, or even for those who are fortunate enough to have gotten an early start. It's available to anyone who is willing to get on the path and stay on it, regardless of age, sex, or previous experience. The trouble is that we have few, if any, maps to guide us on the journey, or even to show us how to find the path. The modern world, in fact, can be viewed as a prodigious conspiracy against mastery. We're continually bombarded with promises of immediate gratification, instant success, and fast, temporary relief, all of which lead in exactly the wrong direction. Later, we'll take a look at the quick-fix, anti-mastery mentality that pervades our society, and see how it not only prevents us from developing our potential skills, but threatens our health, education, career, relationships, and perhaps even our national economic viability. But first, let's examine mastery itself. The master's journey can begin whenever you decide to learn any new skill. How to touch type, how to cook, how to become a lawyer or doctor or accountant. But it achieves a special poignancy, a quality akin to poetry or drama, in the field of sports, where muscles, mind, and spirit come together in graceful and purposive movements through time and space. Sports provide a good starting point for this exploration, in that results of training in the physical realm are rather quickly and clearly visible. So let's take a familiar sport, tennis, as a hypothetical case through which we can derive the principles underlying the mastery of all skills, physical or otherwise. Say you're in fairly good physical shape, but by no means a highly conditioned, skilled athlete. You've played around with movement sports such as volleyball and softball, which involve hand-eye coordination, and you've played a little tennis, but not much, which might be a good thing. If you're going to go for mastery, it's better to start with a clean slate rather than have to unlearn bad habits you picked up while hacking around. Now you've found a teacher, a pro with a reputation for grounding players in the fundamentals, and you've committed yourself to at least 3 visits a week to the tennis court. You're on the path to mastery. It starts with baby steps. The teacher shows you how to hold the racket so that it will hit the ball at the correct moment in time. She has you bring the racket forward in a forehand swing until you find the position of maximum strength of the wrist. She stands in front of you on the same side of the net and tosses balls to your forehand and after each hit, she asks you to tell her if you hit it early or late. She shows you how to move your shoulders and hips together with the motion of the arm and to stride into the ball. She makes corrections, gives encouragement. You feel terribly clumsy and disjointed. You have to think to keep the parts of your body synchronized, and thinking gets in the way of graceful, spontaneous movement. You find yourself becoming impatient. You were hoping to get exercise, but this practice doesn't give you enough even to break a sweat. You like to see the ball go across the net and into the dark green part of the court, but your teacher says you shouldn't even be thinking about that at this stage. You're the type of person who cares a lot about results, and you seem to be getting hardly any results at all. The practice just goes on and on. Hold the racket correctly, know where the racket makes contact with the ball, move shoulders, hips, and arm together, stride into the ball. You seem to be getting exactly nowhere. Then, after about 5 weeks of frustration, a light goes on. The various components of the tennis stroke begin to come together, almost as if your muscles know what they should do. You don't have to think about every little thing. In your conscious awareness, there's more room to see the ball, to meet it cleanly in a stroke that starts low and ends high. You feel the itch to hit the ball harder, to start playing competitively. No chance. Until now, your teacher has been feeding balls to you. You haven't had to move. But now you're going to have to learn to move side to side, back and forth, and on the diagonal, and then set up and swing. Again, you feel clumsy, disjointed. You're dismayed to find that you're losing some of what you'd gained. Just before you're ready to call it quits, you stop getting worse, but you're not getting any better either. Days and weeks pass with no apparent progress. There you are on that damn plateau. For most people brought up in this society, the plateau can be a form of purgatory. It triggers disowned emotions. It flushes out hidden motivations. You realize you came to tennis not only to get exercise, but also to look good, to play with your friends, to beat your friends. You decide to have a talk with your teacher. How long, you ask, will it take you to master this thing? Your instructor responds, "Do you mean how long would it take for you to automatically get into position and hit a forehand effectively to a target?" "Yes." She pauses. It's a question she always dreads. "Well, for someone like you, who starts tennis as an adult, if you practice an hour, 3 times a week, it would take on average 5 years. 5 years? Your heart sinks. Ideally, about half of that would be instruction. Of course, if you're particularly motivated, it could be less than that. You decide to try another question. "How long will it be before I can play competitively?" "Competitively? That's a loaded term. I mean playing to try to beat a friend." "I would say you could probably start playing after about 6 months, but you shouldn't start playing with winning as a major consideration until you have reasonable control of forehand, backhand, and serve, and that would be about 1 year or 1.5 years. Another bitter dose of reality. The teacher goes on to explain. The problem with tennis isn't just that the ball moves and the racket moves, and you have to master all of that, but also that you have to move. In addition, unless you're hitting with a pro who can put the ball in the correct place, a lot of practice time on the court is spent picking up balls. Backboards are helpful. Ball machines are helpful. But playing for points, trying to beat a friend, really comes down to who gets the serve in the court and who misses the ball first. Points last only about 3 hits over the net. You don't get much practice. What you really need is to hit thousands of balls under fairly controlled circumstances at every step along the way. Forehand, backhand, footwork, serve, spin, net play, placement, strategy. And the process is generally incremental. You can't skip stages. You can't really work on strategy, for example, until you've got placement pretty well under control. With the introduction of each new stage, you're going to have to start thinking again, which means things will temporarily fall apart. The truth begins to sink in. Going for mastery in this sport isn't going to bring you the quick rewards you had hoped for. There's a seemingly endless road ahead of you with numerous setbacks along the way, and most important, there's plenty of time on the plateau where long hours of diligent practice gain you no apparent progress at all. Not a happy situation for one who is highly goal-oriented. You realize that you have a decision to make at some point along the journey, if not now. You're tempted to drop tennis and go out looking for another, easier sport, or you might try twice as hard, insist on extra lessons, practice day and night. Or you could quit your lessons and take whatever you've learned out on the court. You could forget about improving your game and just have fun with friends who don't play much better than you. Of course, you could also do what your teacher suggests and stay on the long road to mastery. What will you choose? This question, this moment of choice, comes up countless times in each of our lives, not just about tennis or some other sport, but about everything that has to do with learning, development, change. Sometimes we choose after careful deliberation, but frequently the choice is careless, a barely conscious one, seduced by the siren song of a consumerist, quick-fix society. We sometimes choose a course of action that brings only the illusion of accomplishment, the shadow of satisfaction. And sometimes, knowing little or nothing about the process that leads to mastery, we don't even realize a choice is being offered. Yet even our failures to choose consciously operate as choices, adding to or subtracting from the amount of our potential that we will eventually realize. The evidence is clear. All of us who are born without serious genetic defects are born geniuses. Without an iota of formal instruction, we can master the overarching symbolic system of spoken language, and not just one language, but several. We can decipher the complex code of facial expressions, a feat to paralyze the circuitry of even the most powerful computer. We can decode and in one way or another express the subtleties of emotional nuance. Even without formal schooling, we can make associations, create abstract categories, and construct meaningful hierarchies. What's more, we can invent things never before seen, ask questions never before asked, and seek answers from out beyond the stars. Unlike computers, we can fall in love. What we call intelligence comes in many varieties. Howard Gardner of Harvard University and the Boston University School of Medicine has identified 7 of them: linguistic, musical, logical-mathematical, spatial, bodily-kinesthetic, and 2 types of personal intelligences that might be described as intrapersonal and interpersonal. We vary in our giftedness in these 7 at least. Still, each of us comes equipped with enough raw ability across the board to achieve that seemingly rare and mysterious state we call mastery in some mode of thought and expression, some interpersonal and entrepreneurial enterprise, some art or craft. This is also true in the physical realm. It was once believed that our primitive ancestors were rather pitiable creatures compared with the other animals of the jungles and savannas. Lacking the fangs, claws, and specialized physical abilities of the predators, our forefathers supposedly prevailed only because of their large brains and their ability to use tools. This supposition has downplayed the prodigious human ability to create complex, well-knit social groupings, a challenge which, more than tool-making, accounts for the development of the large brain. It also downplays the human body. Much has been made of the blazing sprint speed of the cheetah, the prodigious leaps of the kangaroo, the underwater skills of the dolphin, and the gymnastic prowess of the chimpanzee. But the fact of the matter is that no animal can match the human animal in all-around athletic ability. If we were to hold a mammal decathlon with events in sprinting, endurance running, long jumping, high jumping, swimming, deep diving, gymnastics, striking, kicking, and burrowing, other animals would win most of the individual events, but a well-trained human would come up with the best overall score. And in one event, endurance running, the human would outperform all other animals of comparable size, as well as some quite a bit larger. If we are born geniuses of thought and feeling, we are also geniuses in potentia of the body. And there is undoubtedly some sport, some physical pursuit, in which each of us can excel. But genius, no matter how bright, will come to naught or swiftly burn out if you don't choose the master's journey. This journey will take you along a path that is both arduous and exhilarating. It will bring you unexpected heartaches and unexpected rewards, and you will never reach a final destination. It would be a paltry skill indeed that could be finally, completely mastered. You'll probably end up learning as much about yourself as about the skill you're pursuing, and, although you'll often be surprised at what and how you learn, your progress towards mastery will almost always take on a characteristic rhythm. The mastery curve. There's really no way around it. Learning any new skill involves relatively brief spurts of progress, each of which is followed by a slight decline to a plateau somewhat higher in most cases than that which preceded it. The curve is necessarily idealized. In the actual learning experience, progress is less regular. The upward spurts vary. The plateaus have their own dips and rises along the way. But the general progression is almost always the same. To take the master's journey, you have to practice diligently, striving to hone your skills to attain new levels of competence. But while doing so, and this is the inexorable fact of the journey, you also have to be willing to spend most of your time on a plateau to keep practicing even when you seem to be getting nowhere. Why does learning take place in spurts? Why can't we make steady upward progress on our way toward mastery? As we saw in the case of tennis, we have to keep practicing an unfamiliar movement again and again until we get it in the muscle memory or program it into the autopilot. The specific mechanism through which this takes place is not completely known, but it probably matches up fairly well with these informal descriptions. Carl Pribram, professor of neuroscience and a pioneering brain researcher at Stanford University, explains it in terms of hypothetical brain-body systems. He starts with a habitual behavior system that operates at a level deeper than conscious thought. This system involves the reflex circuit in the spinal cord, as well as in various parts of the brain to which it is connected. This habitual system makes it possible for you to do things, return a scorching tennis serve, play a guitar chord, ask directions in a new language, without worrying just how you do them. When you start to learn a new skill, however, you do have to think about it, and you have to make an effort to replace old patterns of sensing, movement, and cognition with new. This brings into play what might be called a cognitive system, associated with the habitual system, and an effort system associated with the hippocampus situated at the base of the brain. The cognitive and effort systems become subsets of the habitual system long enough to modify it, to teach it a new behavior. To put it another way, the cognitive and effort systems click into the habitual system and reprogram it. When the job is done, both systems withdraw. Then you don't have to stop and think about, say, the right grip every time you shift your racket. In this light, you can see that those upward surges on the mastery curve are by no means the only time anything significant or exciting is happening. Learning generally occurs in stages. A stage ends when the habitual system has been programmed to the new task and the cognitive and effort systems have withdrawn. This means you can perform the task without making a special effort to think of its separate parts. At this point, there's an apparent spurt of learning, but this learning has been going on all along. How do you best move toward mastery? And to put it simply, you practice diligently, but you practice primarily for the sake of the practice itself. Rather than being frustrated while on the plateau, you learn to appreciate and enjoy it just as much as you do the upward surges. But learning to love the plateau is getting ahead of our story. First, let's meet three characters, the dabbler, the obsessive, and the hacker, who go through life each in his or her own way, choosing not to take the master's journey. Who knows? We might be meeting ourselves. Chapter 2. Meet the dabbler, the obsessive, and the hacker. We all aspire to mastery, but the path is always long and sometimes rocky, and it promises no quick and easy payoffs. So we look for other paths, each of which attracts a certain type of person. The dabbler. The dabbler approaches each new sport, career opportunity, or relationship with enormous enthusiasm. He or she loves the rituals involved in getting started, the spiffy equipment, the lingo, the shine of newness. When he makes his first spurt of progress in a new sport, for example, the dabbler is overjoyed. He demonstrates his form to family, friends, and people he meets on the street. He can't wait for the next lesson. The fall-off from his first peak comes as a shock. The plateau that follows is unacceptable, if not incomprehensible. His enthusiasm quickly wanes. He starts missing lessons. His mind fills up with rationalizations. This really isn't the right sport for him. It's too competitive, non-competitive, aggressive, non-aggressive, boring, dangerous, whatever. He tells everyone that it just doesn't fulfill his unique needs. Starting another sport gives the dabbler a chance to replay the scenario of starting up. Maybe he'll make it to the second plateau this time, maybe not. Then it's on to something else. The same thing applies to a career. The dabbler loves new jobs, new offices, new colleagues. He sees opportunities at every turn. He salivates over projected earnings. He delights in signs of progress, each of which he reports to his family and friends. Uh-oh. There's that plateau again. Maybe this job isn't right for him after all. It's time to start looking around. The dabbler has a long resume. In love relationships, perhaps an unexpected place to look for the signs of mastery, but a good one, the dabbler specializes in honeymoons. He revels in seduction and surrender, the telling of life stories, the display of love's tricks and trappings, the ego on parade. When the initial ardor starts to cool, he starts looking around. To stay on the path of mastery would mean changing himself. How much easier it is to jump into another bed and start the process all over again. The dabbler might think of himself as an adventurer, a connoisseur of novelty, but he's probably closer to being what Carl Jung calls the Puritanus, the eternal kid. Though partners change, he or she stays just the same. The obsessive. The obsessive is a bottom-line type of person, not one to settle for second best. He or she knows results are what count, and it doesn't matter how you get them, just so you get them fast. In fact, he wants to get the stroke just right during the first lesson. He stays after class talking to the instructor. He asks what books and tapes he can buy to help him make progress faster. He leans toward the listener when he talks. His energy is up front when he walks. The obsessive starts out by making robust progress. His first spurt is just what he expected. But when he inevitably regresses and finds himself on a plateau, he simply won't accept it. He redoubles his effort. He pushes himself mercilessly. He refuses to accept his boss's and colleagues' counsel of moderation. He works all night at the office. He's tempted to take shortcuts for the sake of quick results. American corporate managers, by and large, have joined the cult of the bottom line. Their profile is often that of the obsessive. They strive mightily to keep the profit curve angled upward, even if that means sacrificing research and development, long-term planning, patient product development, and plant investment. In relationships, the obsessive lives for the upward surge, the swelling background music, the trip to the stars. He's not like the dabbler. When ardor cools, he doesn't look elsewhere. He tries to keep the starship going by every means at his command. Extravagant gifts, erotic escalation, melodramatic rendezvous. He doesn't understand the necessity for periods of development on the plateau. The relationship becomes a roller coaster ride, with stormy separations and passionate reconciliations. The inevitable breakup involves a great deal of pain for both partners, with very little in the way of learning or self-development to show for it. Somehow, in whatever he is doing, the obsessive manages for a while to keep making brief spurts of upward progress, followed by sharp declines, a jagged ride toward a sure fall. When the fall occurs, the obsessive is likely to get hurt, and so are friends, colleagues, stockholders, and lovers. The hacker. The hacker has a different attitude. After sort of getting the hang of a thing, he or she is willing to stay on the plateau indefinitely. He doesn't mind skipping stages essential to the development of mastery if he can just go out and hack around with fellow hackers. He's the physician or teacher who doesn't bother going to professional meetings, the tennis player who develops a solid forehand and figures he can make do with a ragged backhand. At work, he does only enough to get by, leaves on time or early, takes every break, talks instead of doing his job, and wonders why he doesn't get promoted. The hacker looks at marriage or living together not as an opportunity for learning and development, but as a comfortable refuge from the uncertainties of the outside world. He or she is willing to settle for static monogamy, an arrangement in which both partners have clearly defined and unchanging roles, and in which marriage is primarily an economic and domestic institution. This traditional arrangement sometimes works well enough, but in today's world, two partners are rarely willing to live indefinitely on an unchanging plateau. When your tennis partner starts improving his or her game and you don't, the game eventually breaks up. The same thing applies to relationships. The categories are obviously not quite this neat. You can be a dabbler in love and a master in art. You can be on the path of mastery on your job and a hacker on the golf course, or vice versa. Even in the same field, you can be sometimes on the path of mastery, sometimes an obsessive, and so on. But the basic patterns tend to prevail, both reflecting and shaping your performance, your character, your destiny. At some of my lectures and workshop sessions, I describe the master, the dabbler, the obsessive, and the hacker. I then ask the people in the audience to indicate by a show of hands, leaving the master out, which of the other three would best describe themselves. In almost every case, the response breaks down into nearly even thirds, and the discussion that follows shows how easily most people can identify with the three types who are the subject of this chapter. These characters then have proven useful in helping us see why we're not on the path of mastery. But the real point is to get on that path and start moving. The first challenge we'll meet, as we'll see in the next chapter, is posed by our society. Chapter 3. America's War Against Mastery. If you're planning to embark on a master's journey, you might find yourself bucking current trends in American life. Our hyped-up consumerist society is engaged, in fact, in an all-out war on mastery. We see this most plainly in our value system. Values were once inculcated through the extended family, tribal or village elders, sports and games, the apprenticeship system or traditional schooling, religious training and practice, and spiritual and secular ceremony. With the weakening or withering away of most of these agencies, value-giving in America has taken a strange new turn. Our society is now organized around an economic system that seemingly demands a continuing high level of consumer spending. We are offered an unprecedented number of choices as to how we spend our money. We have to have food, clothing, housing, transportation, and medical care, but within certain limits, we can choose among many alternatives. We are also enticed by a dazzling array of appealing non-necessities, VCRs, vacation cruises, speed boats, microwave ovens. Every time we spend money, we make a clear statement about what we value. There's no clearer or more direct indication. Thus, all inducements to spend money, print advertisements, radio and television commercials, mailers and the like, are primarily concerned with the inculcation of values. They have become, in fact, the chief value givers of this age. Try paying close attention to television commercials. What values do they espouse? Some appeal to fear. Buy our traveler's checks because you're likely to be robbed on your next trip. Some to logic. Even to thrift. Our car compares favorably to its chief competitors in the following ways and is cheaper. Some to snobbery. At an elegant country house, fashionably dressed people are drinking a certain brand of sparkling water. Some to pure hedonism. On a miserable winter day in the city, a young couple chances upon a travel agency. Their eyes focus on a replica of a credit card on the window, and they are instantly transported to a dreamy, tropical paradise. We keep watching, and an underlying pattern will emerge. About half of the commercials, whatever the subject matter, are based on a climactic moment. The cake has already been baked. The family and guests, their faces all aglow, are gathered around to watch an adorable 3-year-old blow out the candles. The race is run and won. Beautiful young people jump up and down in ecstasy as they reach for frosted cans of Diet Cola. Men are shown working at their jobs for all of a second and a half, then it's Miller time. Life at its best, these commercials teach, is an endless series of climactic moments. And the sitcoms and soaps, the crime shows and MTV, all run on the same hyped-up schedule. One, if you make smart-ass one-liners for a half hour, everything will work out fine in time for the closing commercials. Two, people are quite nasty. Don't work hard and get rich quickly. Three, no problem is so serious that it can't be resolved in the wink of an eye as soon as the gleaming barrel of a handgun appears. Four, the weirdest fantasy you can think of can be realized instantly and without effort. In all of this, the specific content isn't nearly as destructive to mastery as is the rhythm. One epiphany follows another. One fantasy is crowded out by the next. Climax is piled upon climax. There's no plateau. The Path of Endless Climax. Two generations of Americans have grown up in the television age, during which consumerism has achieved unprecedented dominance over our value system. It should come as no great surprise that many of us have the idea that our lives, by all rights, should consist of one climax after another. So what do we do when our own day-to-day existence doesn't match up? How do we keep those climactic moments coming without instruction or discipline or practice? It's easy. Take a drug. Of course, it doesn't work. In the long run, it destroys you. But who in the popular and commercial culture has much to say about the long run? Who would be willing to warn in their commercial messages that every attempt to achieve an endless series of climactic moments, whether drug-powered or not, ends like this? The epidemic of gambling currently sweeping across the nation shows how explicit and blatant the campaign against any long-term effort has become. An ad for the Illinois lottery pictured a man scoffing at people buying savings bonds and insisting that the only way an ordinary person could become a millionaire was by playing the lottery. The very first commercial seen during an ABC special on the crisis in our high schools showed a bowl session among a group of attractive young people. The models for this commercial were probably over 21, but could easily have passed for high schoolers. "I'm going for the Trans Am," one of them said. Another informed her friends that she would take the Hawaiian vacation, and a third said he was going to win the cash prize of $50,000. While there seemed no doubt in these happy youths' minds that they were going to win the sweepstakes in question, they were statistically more likely to die by drowning in a cistern, cesspool, or well. A radio commercial for another sweepstakes dramatized the story of a young man who was ashamed to be seen by his brother while cooking hamburgers in a fast food restaurant. He explains that he's working to buy tickets to a pro football game. The brother asks why he's doing that when he could try for the tickets in a sweepstakes. The young man is immediately convinced. He then burns the hamburger he's cooking and serves the French fries still frozen. "I don't care," he says happily. "I can win tickets. I don't need this job." If you could impute some type of central intelligence to all of these commercial messages, you would have to conclude that the nation is bent on self-destruction. In any case, you might suspect that the disproportionate incidence of drug abuse in the United States, especially of drugs that give you a quick high, springs not so much from immoral or criminal impulses as from a perfectly understandable impulse to replicate the most visible, most compelling American vision of the good life, an endless series of climactic moments. This vision isn't just an invention of television. It resonates in the rhetoric about scoring. I don't care how you win, just win. About effortless learning, instant celebrities, instant millionaires, and the number one finger raised in the air when you score just once. It is the ruling entrepreneurial vision of America, even among young ghetto drug dealers. "Based on my experience," writes anthropologist Philippe Bourgeois, who spent 5 years of living in and studying the culture of East Harlem, "I believe the assertion of the culture of poverty theorists that the poor have been badly socialized and do not share mainstream values is wrong. On the contrary, ambitious, energetic inner-city youths are attracted to the underground economy precisely because they believe in the rags-to-riches American dream. Like many in the mainstream, they are frantically trying to get their piece of the pie as fast as possible." The quick-fix, anti-mastery mentality touches almost everything in our lives. Look at modern medicine and pharmacology. Fast, temporary relief is the battle cry. Symptoms receive immediate attention. Underlying causes remain in the shadows. More and more research studies show that most illnesses are caused by environmental factors or way of life. The typical 12-minute office visit doesn't give the doctor time to get to know the patient's face, much less his or her way of life. Does give time for writing a prescription. A pioneering study by Dr. Dean Ornish and his associates in San Francisco has proven conclusively that coronary artery disease, our number one cause of death, can be reversed by a long-term regimen of diet, moderate exercise, yoga, meditation, and group support. No drugs, no operations. This program has been criticized by some doctors as too radical. If this is radical, then what do these doctors consider conservative? Is it a bypass operation that will split your chest wide open, that has a 5% chance of causing death, a 30% chance of causing neurological damage, a 50% chance of being unnecessary, an operation which might have to be repeated after a few years and which costs $30,000? But all that doesn't seem to matter. At least it's a quick fix. Business and industry? Perhaps no other area of American life is more in need of the principles of mastery. Gone is talk of balanced, long-term growth, writes Ralph E. Winter in a Wall Street Journal article on the current fad of streamlining. Impatient shareholders and well-heeled corporate raiders have seen to that. Now, anxious executives, fearing for their jobs or their companies, are focusing their efforts on trimming operations and shuffling assets to improve near-term profits, often at the expense of both balance and growth. The leveraged buyout sums it all up. There's an enormous climax. Certain people make a lot of money in a short time. Very little, if any, real value is added to the corporation or to the national economy, and the corporate raider becomes a culture hero. But today's hero can become tomorrow's pariah. Already there are signs of a massive and growing disillusionment with our instant billionaires, and also with crash diets, miracle drugs, both legal and illegal, lotteries, sweepstakes, and all the flash and clutter that accrues from the worship of quick, effortless success and fulfillment. If we need a reminder of just how disastrous the war against mastery can be, we have the SNL crisis, which brought quick rewards to a few and is bringing prolonged hardship to many. Make no mistake, it's all connected. The same climate of thought that would lead some people to the promise that they can learn a new skill or lose weight without patient, long-term effort leads others to the promise of great riches without the production of value in return. A war that can't be won. I'm aware that this critique of certain American values comes at a moment of great triumph for America and the West. Throughout the world, even in nations whose leaders were vilest, there's a rising desire for the American way of life. Totalitarian governments are standing on very shaky ground these days. The hunger for free democratic governance has never been stronger. Communism, with its centralized economic planning and control, is in full retreat. Freedom is doubtless the way to go, and throughout most of the world, it's growing clear that nations need the system of feedback and individual incentive that obtains in a free market economy. The victory is real, and celebration is in order, but so is some cautious self-examination. For there's perhaps no more dangerous time for any society than its moment of greatest triumph. It would be truly foolish to let the decline of communism blind us to the long-term contradictions in a free market economy, unrestrained by considerations of the environment and social justice, and driven by heedless consumerism, instant gratification, and the quick fix. Our dedication to growth at all costs puts us on a collision course with the environment. Our dedication to the illusion of endless climaxes puts us on a collision course with the human psyche. Mastery applies to nations as well as to individuals. Our present national prosperity is built on a huge deficit and trillions of dollars worth of overdue expenditures on environmental cleanup, infrastructure repair, education, and social services, the quick fix mentality. The failure to deal with the deficit goes along with easy credit and the continuing encouragement of individual consumption at the expense of saving and longer-term gain. The celebration of results over process is reflected in shoddy workmanship and the ascendancy of imported products. The urgent commercial appeals that paint life as a series of climactic moments are not unrelated to the current epidemics of drug abuse and gambling. Full shelves in the supermarkets and full lanes on the superhighways don't make up for the pitiful cries of crack babies, the breakdown of learning in and out of the schools, and the growing disparity between the rich and the poor. America is still the most exciting of nations. Its freedom, its energy, its talent for innovation still inspire the world. But our time of grace might be running out. In the long run, the war against mastery, the path of patient, dedicated effort without attachment to immediate results, is a war that can't be won. Chapter 4. Loving the Plateau. Early in life, we are urged to study hard so that we'll get good grades. We are told to get good grades so that we'll graduate from high school and get into college. We are told to graduate from high school and get into college so that we'll get a good job. We are told to get a good job so that we can buy a house and a car. Again and again, we are told to do one thing only so that we can get something else. We spend our lives stretched on an iron rack of contingencies. Contingencies, no question about it, are important. The achievement of goals is important. But the real juice of life, whether it be sweet or bitter, is to be found not nearly so much in the products of our efforts as in the process of living itself and how it feels to be alive. We are taught in countless ways to value the product, the prize, the climactic moment. But even after we've just caught the winning pass in the Super Bowl, there's always tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. If our life is a good one, a life of mastery, most of it will be spent on the plateau. If not, a large part of it may well be spent in restless, distracted, ultimately self-destructive attempts to escape the plateau. The question remains, where in our upbringing, our schooling, our career, are we explicitly taught to value, to enjoy, even to love the plateau, the long stretch of diligent effort with no seeming progress? I was fortunate in my middle years to have found Aikido, a discipline so difficult and resistant to the quick fix that it showed me the plateau in sharp, bold relief. When I first started, I simply assumed that I would steadily improve. The first plateaus were relatively short, and I could ignore them. After about a year and a half, however, I was forced to recognize that I was on a plateau of formidable proportions. This recognition brought a certain shock and disappointment, but somehow I persevered and finally experienced an apparent spurt of learning. The next time my outward progress stopped, I said to myself, oh, damn, another plateau. After a few more months, there was another spurt of progress, and then, of course, the inevitable plateau. This time, something marvelous happened. I found myself thinking, oh boy, another plateau. Good. I can just stay on it and keep practicing. Sooner or later, there'll be another spurt. It was one of the warmest moments on my journey. The joy of regular practice. At that time, the Aikido school I attended was only 18 months old, and there were no regular students above blue belt. Our teachers, the only black belts around, seemed to exist in an entirely different plane from the one on which we moved. I never even considered the possibility that I would rise to that rarefied plane. So there I was, an impatient, rather driven person who had always gone for the quickest, most direct route to a given goal, practicing regularly and hard for no particular goal at all, just for its own sake. Months would pass with no break in the steady rhythm of my practice. It was something new in my life, a revelation. The endless succession of classes was rewarding, precisely because it was, in the Zen sense, nothing special. I went to class 3 or 4 times a week, from 7 to 9 p.m. When it was time to drive to the dojo, practice hall in the city, the problems and distractions of the day began falling away. Just folding the quilted white cotton G practice uniform softened my breathing and brought me a feeling of peace. The drive took about a half hour across the bridge into the city, over a long hill that taxed my car's lowest gear, then finally down to a broad and noisy avenue noted for row upon row of car dealerships. Despite the noise outside, climbing the stairs to the second-story dojo was like entering a sanctuary, a place both alien to my customary existence and altogether familiar. I loved everything about it, the ritual that was always the same yet always new, bowing upon entering, pulling my membership card from the rack on the front desk, changing to my gi in the dressing room. I loved the comforting smell of sweat, the subdued talk. I loved coming out of the dressing room and checking to see which other students were already warming up. I loved bowing again as I stepped on the mat, feeling the cool, firm surface on the soles of my feet. I loved taking my place in the long row of Aikidoists, all sitting in Seiza, the Japanese meditation position. I loved the entry of our teacher, the ritual bows, the warm-up techniques, and then my heart pounding, my breath rushing as the training increased in speed and power. It wasn't always like that. Sometimes when the moment came to go to class, I would be feeling particularly lazy. On those occasions, I would be tempted to do almost anything rather than face myself once again on the mat. And sometimes, I would give in to that inevitable human resistance against doing what's best for us and waste an evening distracting myself. I knew quite well, however, that when I did overcome my lethargy, I would be rewarded with a little miracle. I knew that no matter how I felt on climbing the dojo stairs, 2 hours later, after hundreds of throws and falls, I would walk out tingling and fully alive, feeling so good, in fact, that the night itself would seem to sparkle and gleam. This joy, I repeat, had little to do with progress or the achievement of goals. I was taken totally by surprise, in fact, when one of my teachers called a fellow student and me into his office after a weekend of marathon training and handed us brown belts, the rank next to black belt. One night, about a year later, the four most advanced brown belts in the school happened to have a conversation during which we obliquely touched upon the possibility that we ourselves might someday achieve the rank of black belt. The idea was both exciting and troubling, and when I next came to class, I was aware of something new. The worm of ambition was eating stealthily away at the center of my belly. Maybe it was coincidence, but within 3 weeks of that conversation, all four of us suffered serious injuries: a broken toe, torn ligaments in the elbow, a dislocated shoulder, mine, and an arm broken in three places. These injuries were effective teachers. After recovering, we settled back into steady, goalless practice. Another year and a half was to pass before the four of us made black belt. This isn't to say that we didn't practice hard. The hacker gets on a plateau and doesn't keep working. As I think back on that period, I realize that in spite of our many flaws, we were definitely on the path of mastery. Unlike the hacker, we were working hard, doing the best we could to improve our skills. But we had learned the perils of getting ahead of ourselves, and now were willing to stay on the plateau for as long as was necessary. Ambition still was there, but it was tamed. Once again, we enjoyed our training, we loved the plateau, and we made progress. This essential paradox becomes especially clear in a martial art that is exceptionally demanding, unforgiving, and rewarding. But it holds true, I think, in every human activity that involves significant learning, mental, physical, emotional, or spiritual. And despite our society's urgent and effective war against mastery, there are still millions of people who, while achieving great things in their work, are dedicated to the process as well as to the product, people who love the plateau. Life for these people is especially vivid and satisfying. "It's my truest happiness," a writer friend told me. "It's the time when all the crap goes away. As soon as I walk into my study, I start getting cues of pleasure, my books on the shelves, the particular odor of the room. These cues begin to tie into what I've written and what I'm going to write. Even if I've stayed up all night, my fatigue disappears, just like that. There's a whole range of pleasure waiting for me, from making one sentence work to getting a new insight. A lot of people go for things only because a teacher told them they should, or their parents," said Olympic gymnast Peter Vidmar. "People who get into something for the money, the fame, or the medal can't be effective. When you discover your own desire, you're not going to wait for other people to find solutions to your problems. You're going to find your own. I set goals for myself, but underlying all the goals and the work was the fact that I enjoyed it. I thought gymnastics was fun, and I had no idea that I might someday be an Olympian." "The routine is important to me," said a successful painter who works in her studio for 4 hours, 5 times a week. "When I get started, there's a wonderful sense of well-being. I like to feel myself plodding along. I specifically choose the word plod. When it's going good, I feel this is the essential me. It's the routine itself that feeds me. If I didn't do it, I'd be betraying the essential me." When I was a boy, my father would let me go to his office with him on Saturday mornings. I don't think he had to go. He was simply drawn there. It was his place of practice. He was in the fire insurance business, and while he went through his mail, he would let me wander through the office, free to play with the marvelous mechanical contrivances of those days, the stately upright typewriters, the hand-operated adding machines, the staplers and paper punches, and the old dictaphone on which I could record a thin facsimile of my voice. I loved the Saturday morning silence and the smells of glue and ink, rubber erasers, and well-worn wood. I would play with the machines and make paper airplanes for a while, but then, more likely than not, I would go into my father's office and just sit there watching him, fascinated by the depth of his concentration. He was in a world of his own, entirely relaxed and at the same time entirely focused, as he opened the envelopes of various sizes and shapes, sorted the contents into piles, and made notes to his secretary. And all the time he worked, his lips were slightly parted, his breath steady and calm, his eyes soft, and his hands moving steadily, almost hypnotically. I remember wondering even then, when I was not more than 10 years old, if I would ever have such a power of concentration or take such pleasure in my work. Certainly not at school, certainly not during my scattered, abortive attempts to do homework. I knew even then that he was an ambitious man with a burning desire for the extrinsic rewards of his work, including public recognition and even fame, but I also knew that he loved his work, the feel, the rhythm, the texture of it. My father's colleagues later told me that he was among the best in his field. Still, the public recognition he might have wished for never materialized, nor did the fame. But recognition is often unsatisfying, and fame is like seawater for the thirsty. Love of your work, willingness to stay with it, even in the absence of extrinsic reward, is good food and good drink. The Face of Mastery. The look of deep concentration on my father's face as he did the work he loved is not unlike the expression that could be seen on the face of almost anyone on the path of mastery, even in the throes of physical exertion. Sports photography, as we know it, has been captured by the thrill of victory, agony of defeat school. Again and again we're shown climactic moments, prodigious exertion, faces contorted with pain or triumph, almost to the exclusion of anything else. But it seems to me that mastery's true face is relaxed and serene, sometimes faintly smiling. In fact, those we most admire in sports seem at times to enter another dimension, besieged by opposing players, battered by the screams of the crowd. They make the difficult, even the supernatural, seem easy, and manage somehow to create harmony where chaos might otherwise prevail. In preparing the Esquire special on mastery, I decided to see if I could find a series of pictures that would illustrate the face of mastery. I went through hundreds of prints and transparencies from the major photo agencies, and there, scattered among the thrill of victory, agony of defeat shots, was just what I was looking for. Stephen Scott making the last turn in a mile race, his face serene, his body relaxed. Greg Louganis at the edge of the diving board, his face a study in calm concentration. Peter Vidmar doing floor exercises, his body in an impossibly strenuous position, his face reflective and composed. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar launching his skyhook basketball shot over the hand of an opposing player, his face a revelation of inner delight. Abdul-Jabbar is not a man of small ego. I'm sure he loved the money, the fame, the privileges his career brought him, but he loved the skyhook more. Goals and contingencies, as I've said, are important, but they exist in the future and the past, beyond the pale of the sensory realm. Practice, the path of mastery, exists only in the present. You can see it, hear it, smell it, feel it. To love the plateau is to love the eternal now. To enjoy the inevitable spurts of progress and the fruits of accomplishment, then serenely to accept the new plateau that waits just beyond them. To love the plateau is to love what is most essential and enduring in your life. Part 2. The Five Master Keys. Introduction. The human individual is equipped to learn and go on learning prodigiously from birth to death, and this is precisely what sets him or her apart from all other known forms of life. Man has at various times been defined as a building animal, a working animal, and a fighting animal, but all of these definitions are incomplete and finally false. Man is a learning animal, and the essence of the species is encoded in that simple term. In this light, the mastery of skills that are not genetically programmed is the most characteristically human of all activities. The first and best of this learning involves no formal arrangements whatever. The world itself is school enough. We all participate in a master's journey in early childhood when we learn to talk or to walk. Every adult or older child around us is a teacher of language, the type of teacher who smiles at success, permits approximations, and isn't likely to indulge in lectures, that is, the best type. We achieve an upright stance and bipedal locomotion with the help of the same encouraging, permissive instructors, along with the immediate and decisive assistance of gravity, a master teacher if ever there was.